So, yes, Buddhist symbols is the theme of the whole series we're going to do. So I'm going to give a survey. I'm going to go through some pictures of a number of Buddhist symbols. And do chip in if you want to know any more about them or if you've got any comments about them. And some of them we'll be going back to in much more detail during the series. And I don't actually know all of them. Well, I've got about the next 6 weeks mapped out, but I don't know exactly what symbols we'll be looking at. So if you've got any requests, let me know and we could go into them. And I'm starting here with a Dharma wheel flanked by two deer. And there's a lot in this. This is on a temple roof in Tibet or Nepal. Is it a symbol? Are they symbols? Are the deer symbols? Is the wheel a symbol? So one way of looking at a symbol is that it's something invisible that stands for... Sorry, something visible that stands for something invisible. That's a very, very simple way of looking at it, isn't it? But it's a little bit more to it than that, at least from a Buddhist point of view, because it's something which you can bring to mind through your senses, through an object like this, or maybe a mental image, which somehow connects you with an element of your experience which is not really definable, which is, in a sense, on another level, maybe very significant on another level. And so we look at this wheel. Well, if you know something about how it arose in Indian history, you'll realize that, to some extent, it's the disk of the sun. And when we look at the sun, it may be that the sun conveys something for us. And I could start to put it in words, but as I said before the meditation, the words are just words. But this is a talk, so I've got to do it in words, I'm afraid. But the images are here on the wall, and they're more important. So what does the wheel convey? What does the sun convey? And we try not to answer that question. We try not to let it tie anything down. We just try to let it... help our mind to expand into an area that it maybe wouldn't expand into if it wasn't for the help of the symbol. So when we look at the sun, we open to the possibility of the sun telling us something beyond what we know of the sun. And you probably know that William Blake's famous quote that when I look, I'm asked, when I look at the sun, do you not see a round ball of fire? And I say, no, I don't. I see a host of angels singing, you know, heavenly, what's it, all that sort of thing. All praise to God Almighty or something like that. So that was what the sun conjured up for William Blake. It conjured up enormous heavenly choirs of praise and so on. And in ancient India, the sun was a symbol of sovereignty. And so was the wheel, the chakra. And it's said that the old Indian kings would have a special chariot made with a huge golden wheel. They'd attach it to a very fit horse, and they'd pat the horse on the rump, and off the horse would gallop. And people would follow after it, and they'd see how far it got. And when it got to a place where some hostile neighbouring tribes turned it back, they'd say, oh, this must be the boundary of the kingdom. So the horse with its great wheel was sent down all the roads and all the directions of the kingdom to establish the boundary of the king's kingdom. And he was known as a wheel-turning monarch, a wheel-rolling monarch, because he was the one who had the wheel. And the wheel became something that would appear in the sky. You're going to ask something?
Yeah, it's just occurred to me... like this, you know, the wheel being invented, and then it's a very old Buddhism being very old or something. And the wheel would have been at that time maybe, you know, the best invention ever. You know, and to align this idea with this brilliant invention is something that has happened, you know, quite a lot since as well, with mirrors and cameras, and the mind's like a computer, and it's like a camera,
something that really impresses us. Yeah. Becomes the symbol for what is most important for us, maybe. I agree. And then when Buddhism came along, by analogy with the wheel-turning monarch, the Buddha was known as the wheel-turner. He was known as the one who turned the wheel. But in his case, he turned the wheel of truth. and so it was given 8 spokes. So here you get an artificial symbol arising, where the 8 spokes of the wheel start to remind you of the Noble Eightfold Path. And in a way, it sort of helps as a sort of mnemonic. And there, the symbol is getting a little bit more deliberate and a little bit more conceptual. But they don't always have 8 spokes. I'll just go back to the one against the mountains. The deer, of course, in case you don't know why there are deer there, it's because the first time the Buddha taught the Dharma was in the deer park at Sarnath. And we imagine all these very tame deer sitting around, munching, chewing on the cud, listening to the Buddha's talking. You know. Yes. So the wheel is flanked by 2. Someone may have seen one of these in London, by the way, if you're very observant. Anyone know where you can see one of these in
Richmond.
London?
Richmond?
Maybe, yeah, I don't know. Maybe Richmond, but I'm not thinking of that one.
Battersea Park?
There might be one there. Well, the one I'm thinking of is at the London Buddhist Centre. If you go outside the London Buddhist Centre, you look over it's an old fire station, and over the doors, there is a Dharma wheel flanked by the 2 deer, made in brass, I think. Now,
is that covered in gold or bronze or brass?
Gold leaf, yeah. Oh. Yeah. Now, this one is, I think this is the actual thing. It's an amazingly good state of preservation. This dates to about 250 BC. And this is the top of one of King Ashoka's columns. King Ashoka, the great Buddhist emperor who renounced violence and encouraged people to practice Buddhism through the whole of India. And he, in order to spread this message of non-violence and the importance of spiritual practice, he erected all these columns which had inscriptions on them. And the top of the columns, they were surmounted by lions. They weren't always exactly like this, but they were usually, well, at least in this particular one and other ones, you had 4 lions, 1 for each of the directions. Underneath the lions, you had these Dharma wheels, but without 8 spokes, with many, many spokes, and animals in between them. And in fact, there would have been a large Dharma wheel on the top of the lions. So this is Ashoka's column. And again, you may recognise this from somewhere else.
Isn't it part of the Indian national iconography?
It is the emblem of India.
Yeah, it's the Ashoka, the Ashoka wheel that they have on the...
That's right,
Indian,
yeah.
Indian,
yeah.
So
there's the flag, there's the Indian flag, which has the wheel. So it's derived from Buddhism, it's the Ashoka wheel of Dharma, the Dharma chakra, the wheel of Dharma, which is also, as I say, on the column. And the column, this is the official... In India, you're not allowed to use this on your letterheads because it's an official emblem of the Indian nation. So it has to be restricted just to the Indian nation. But I think it was Nehru. It started in the... Well, India gained independence in 1947. And by the early 50s, they were using this. And I think it was Nehru, who was a great admirer of the Buddha, although not really a Buddhist himself, who decided to use this as the emblem.
Why did they choose lions?
Well, the lion was... The Buddha was often known as the Lion of Men. So it could be that. I mean, the Asiatic lion, of course, it was the king of the beasts in the jungle in India, and there's a tale that when the lion roars, all the other beasts fall silent. And so some of the Buddha's own teachings were known as lion's roar, or lion roars. So he was associated with lions. You'll often see lions holding up, if he's on a platform, there'll be lions holding up the platform. So it could be that. But then it was also, lions were also associated with kingship in India. I don't know if anyone else knows more about the symbolism. We're coming already to some animal symbolism. We've got the deer, we've got the lions. I'm going to come to the more animals later. And animals are very rich in their symbolism, aren't they? The message they convey to us. And lion in particular.
Actually, it's just that the lion's a ferocious carnivore.
It's a ferocious carnivore, yeah. Well, we think of Buddhism as being very, very peaceful and so on, don't we? Yeah. I'm going to come back a little bit later to the ferociousness of Buddhism, I hope. But yeah, there's some... it's not necessary. It's peaceful in the sense it doesn't want to hurt people, but it can be ferocious in other senses. And the Buddha's teaching was quite ferocious in some ways. And I think maybe that's why it was likened to the roaring of a lion, which makes all the other beasts fall silent. Now, in early Buddhist art, it used to be thought that the Buddha was not depicted in early Buddhist art. And instead, there would be something else depicted emblematic of the Buddha. And I think this is from the stupa at Sanchi. So this is quite early piece of Buddhist carving. And here we have the Dharma wheel once again, a many-spoked Dharma wheel.
What's that thing hanging off?
Yeah, hanging here, I was also wondering.
Hanging well, off the hub.
I'm very glad you asked me that, because I don't know the answer. Maybe if you want to spin the Dharma wheel, you've got a thing you put around it and you sort of give it a tug, you know, because it looks like a skein of wool or something, doesn't it? And then we've got the Bodhi tree. Is there a Bodhi tree in that previous one? No, I think there is a Bodhi tree above all this. So sometimes the Buddha is depicted as the Dharma wheel, which means this is the Buddha doing his teaching. And there's no Buddha there, there's just a Dharma wheel. Sometimes there's a Bodhi tree, as in this one. So there's the Bodhi tree, covered with garlands and necklaces and things. And that shows that's the Buddha at the time of his enlightenment. And the previous one is an actual Bodhi tree, I think, in Thailand, this particular one. To show you what the Bodhi tree looks like. And then we also have the Buddha's footprints. Sometimes he's depicted by a pair of footprints, which have a Dharma wheel in the middle of them. And it said you could, if you followed the Buddha, you know, if you were a kind of a Sherlock Holmes type and you were interested in following somebody by their footprints, you could always tell it was the Buddha because there was a little Dharma wheel in the middle of his footprint. And anyway, this signifies, if you don't mind me saying what it symbolises, which of course is a mistake to say that, but this symbolises the Buddha's touring, the Buddha's travelling, the Buddha's meeting many, many people.
Did the tree actually represent? Well, were they meant to actually represent?
This is what is thought. This is what is thought. Yes, they stand for the Buddha, and I think this is in some cases it's obvious because you'll actually have an empty chair there with the underneath the Bodhi tree. It is, and also there are disciples on either side. You know. So in many ways it's clear that this does represent the Buddha.
Yes, Stiramati didn't seem to think this in his.
Well, that's interesting. Well, maybe or maybe not. I think what's now been realised is that it's not that there was a taboo against representing the Buddha.
Right.
Okay. So there are images of the Buddha from the same time as these images.
Yes. Right.
And I'll come on to that in a minute. So it's not that you weren't allowed to represent the Buddha, it's just that sometimes they seem to have used a symbol to represent the Buddha, or to evoke the Buddha in some way.
But it was before the images of Buddha came.
Well, this is what they used to say.
But
I think now, what they're now saying is that there are no examples of symbols any earlier than there are examples of images of the Buddha.
I see.
So who knows? And of course, there are several hundred years after the time of the Buddha when we have nothing. There's virtually no... India doesn't preserve archaeology very well. So unless people did things in stone, it doesn't really survive from those early times. So Ashoka is the first one. The first Buddhist stuff that survives is from the time of Ashoka. But he's 200 years after the Buddha. And even after Ashoka, there's very little. So it is quite interesting. Yeah, so when we say A symbolises B, it can be very misleading. The whole point about symbolism is that it's not a conceptual process, but yet you can talk about it. But when you talk about it, you have to remember you're just evoking it. And really, the message is there in the symbol itself, is there in if you like, the image itself. Although, as I'm going to say later, it's not necessarily just visual symbolism. So we've got the footprints.
Red promise, sorry.
Yeah.
Are those things coming down from the... Are those mala beads coming down from the...
They're malas and garlands of flowers, yeah.
Oh, right.
So, yes, so then we have the early images of the Buddha. This one is from Gandhara in Pakistan. You see the lions underneath again. So it seems that people did... That one suggestion, at least, is that at first they thought it was going to be really difficult to depict the Buddha. Then they saw Greek art and they realised the possibilities that were there in sculpture. And they started... Some of the early Gandhara ones are very, very similar to Greek to Greek art. But then gradually an Indian style developed. There's something actually in here which I was hoping to show you. It may turn up later. It looks like it's got out of order. But I wanted to show you a little coin, which is probably the first known depiction of the Buddha, with the word Bodo in Greek on it. So I hope that'll turn up later. So I just wanted to look at some of these images of the Buddha. They're very different ones from different countries. I've chosen a range of them, just a few, so that we can have a sense of what does the Buddha, the face of the Buddha, or the posture of the Buddha convey. This one is from Java, from the great temple at Borobudur. This is about 1,200 years old, or 1,300 years old. Does it sort of say anything, do you find, the face of the Buddha? Or the one downstairs? Or this one? This is from that big Chinese Buddha's exhibition they had a few years ago. I think it was in the British Museum. Some really very, very beautiful Buddha faces, I think. So you do get this sense, don't you, I think, of serenity and a very sort of calm happiness. A good sculptor can manage to get that. This is a Gupta image, I think, an Indian Gupta image. So this is sometime after the Greek influence and where several Indian styles started to emerge. So although they're so different from each other, for me at least, images of the Buddha do convey something. And then, of course, there is an iconography of them. You know, he's normally shown in meditation, usually with his eyes closed or just half open, very still looking, very poised, very balanced. And here I've chosen a Western one by Arloka, who's a member of our order. This is from Norwich. It's a lovely triptych.
Really nice.
Yes. Beautiful. So you see what he's done here is he's set the Buddha against an urban background.
Yeah.
That looks very... I'm of Greek background, and I've been inside a lot of Orthodox Greek
yes,
churches.
Yes, that's interesting. Yeah.
It's a very classic Greek Christian...
Yeah, I think he was influenced by icons, the Greek icons and things. Yeah, I think, and also some Spanish ones as well.
Very nice.
Yeah, and here we have another symbol turning up, the sun and the moon, the sun and the moon, for the Buddha and the Bodhisattva. And I don't rather like this. This is from Korea. But it's a very friendly,
really
cheerful sort of Buddha. Not meditating, but actually standing. Standing
North
Buddha.
Or South?
What's that?
North or South?
North or South Korea? I assume it's from South Korea, but I don't know, actually. I think Buddhism has been rather suppressed in the North. You notice there are flames on the aura, this one. So a lot of Chinese images often have flames around the aura. Again, something quite vigorous and violent, in a sense.
When does that date from?
I don't actually know how old that one is. I think it's medieval, like 1400s, 1500s.
So is that Buddha in the middle and then Kuan Yin? Or?
It's two bodhisattvas. It's probably Kuan Yin and Mahasthamaprapta, I think, yes. In other words, it's the two main bodhisattvas from the White Lotus Sutra.
Buddha looks very young in that depiction.
Almost childlike, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
Quite chubby and childlike, yes.
Yeah.
But I rather like that one.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I want to do a look at symbols in a number of different areas as we go through, having had that as sort of introductory. The first one is symbols of the human predicament. And I'll particularly just have a brief look at the Wheel of Life as a symbol of, you know, what is wrong with life. Trying to help you to see through the problems in life. And then I'll look at symbols of the human unfolding, of the path, if you like, of the process of self-understanding and going through life. And then I'll look at some symbols that, it seems to me, are intended as sort of encouragement. They sort of look at different aspects of human life and human psychology, the mind, and they sort of depict them in dharmic and perfected sort of ways. and then maybe some symbols of perfection or of the goal, particularly the jewels and the mandala. And all of these will be coming back, or some of these at least will be coming back to later in the series. So the Wheel of Life, I expect you're familiar with the Wheel of Life, but just in a way it's an interesting one, this one, because it's a teaching's composite symbol. And it is in a way quite well, it's quite worked out. So you have to have it explained, really. It would be probably some of it, you'd look at it and you say, wow, that's what that's conveying to me, you know. But without the explanations, you might look at this and say, what on earth is going on here? That's my view, at least. So in that sense, it's a slightly, it's not a perfect symbol. But on the other hand, once you've been taught it, it can work quite well.
Are these the three great delusions or something?
These are the three root poisons, they're mm-hmm. called, yeah. So the pig is delusion, the snake is aversion, and the sometimes a cockerel and sometimes a dove, and it's so stylized I can't tell which that one is for craving. And then you have the white and the white path of virtue, the black path of evil, if you like, and loads of other things go on in the Wheel of Life. And you also have the six realms, of course, you know, the hungry ghosts, for example. So you look at that, maybe you can recognise yourself. You realise that symbolises how I am sometimes. I'm in my addictive phase. I'm in an addictive phase of my personality. And here's a hungry ghost from the hungry ghost realm with a tiny little neck and a big, huge belly. Mm-hmm. Never satisfied. And then you have the links going round. So you get 12 of these links. Each of them itself is a symbol. This is, I've just chosen one of them. And this is monkeys climbing up trees, picking fruit. So does anyone know what this is supposed to be conveying in terms of the 12 links? It's actually quite literal, this one.
Is it grasp?
It's grasping, grasp. That's right, yes. So they're grasping the fruit out of the tree. So it's said that if you're not careful, when you have a pleasant feeling, it'll tend to lead you through into craving. And if you're not careful with the craving will lead you through into grasping. Mm-hmm. And you just simply try to repeat that pleasant feeling, which is how you get onto an addictive cycle. Mm-hmm. So it's all this kind of teaching. So the symbols, you know, it could be, of course, many people in ancient India and the other Buddhist countries would have been illiterate. So to have the Wheel of Life, a visual teaching aid that helps you to understand all this, could be really useful. And you may memorise the symbols that they'd be explained to you. Say, oh yes, they've got the monkey grasping, and then we've got the. After that, we've got the couple making love, which is becoming, and then we've got birth, and then we've got death and old age, and so on. You go around it. And then here's another one. I rather like this picture as well, which is not from the Wheel of Life. It's another symbol of the human predicament. Does anyone is this familiar to anybody? This. Yes, it's how difficult it is to find a human life, to find a truly human life. And so it's a story the Buddha told, or an image the Buddha himself used, which was very popular. This is a Chinese, I think, or no, Japanese. It's a Japanese image of it. So there's a blind turtle who lives in the bottom of the ocean. And once every 100 years, he comes up to the surface to see what's going on. Floating on the surface of the ocean, there is a plank of wood with a hole in it. So the chance of finding a human birth, once you lose it, is similar to the chance of the blind turtle just by happening to stick his head up through the hole when he comes up to the surface. He's got a fairly good chance here because he's quite close to it, so he may manage it this time.
Complete rubbish, isn't it?
You think we don't? We think we have a better chance than that, do you?
Well, I thought actually it was all. We were kind of having a human rebirth is kind of rather. We want, you know, we just have one after another. So.
Well, this is when you've lost it. So this is that if you lose your human, this is how difficult it is to become. If you were something other than a human,
or a worm.
or a worm or something, yeah. Once you're a worm, you can make progress, but it's going to take you a very, very long time. A lot of worm lives before you'll actually get stick your head up through the earth again. So it's a warning. It's saying, look, the human life is precious. Don't lose it. It's really precious. You need to make full progress now, because otherwise you may end up like the blind turtle. So not only is it an animal, it's also blind as well. And also there's not many holes in bits of wood. So it may work for some, it may not work for others.
Right. It doesn't work for me. Just the whole thing of you better be careful, or
yeah, you better else. Behave yourself. Yeah,
and yes. The whole fear thing of going to hell and stuff like that.
Well, being reborn is it's just an encouragement to live a human life.
The idea is to live a human, make full use of your human life. Yeah. So it's not so much being good, it's being meaningful, making your life meaningful, I think. Okay, so that's enough on the human predicament. Is there any questions on that before we... on these things?
Oh, God, are you recording this?
I'm going to edit you out.
So the next thing I wanted to do is to look at images of unfolding, of human unfolding. And possibly the most popular one in Buddhism, which definitely goes back to the time of the Buddha, is the flower, in particular the lotus blossom. So this is the pink lotus. The pink lotus is known as the Padma in Sanskrit. Each of the lotuses has got a different name. So the blue one's called the Utpala. The red one's called the Kamala, as in Kamala Shila, who we have here. And the white one's called the Pundarika.
Pundarika?
I think so, yeah. Pundarika. Pandara means white. So they're all... in a way, there's double symbolism with the lotus. There's two different things. So one of them is the sense that... I think I mentioned this in the thing I sent out, the email I sent out. It's as if the lotus starts deep down in the mud and it gradually grows up towards the surface. It breaks the surface as a tight bud, and then if the sun is shining, that bud will gradually open until it's really beautiful, fully open like this. And so human life is said to be similar. So it's an organic process of growing and unfolding. So it's a very encouraging thing. And the Buddha is said to have had this image, this symbol, if you like, soon after the Enlightenment, of looking out over the world and saying it's like a pond of red, white, and blue lotuses. In all sorts of different stages of development, and those that are have emerged from the water, at least those will be receptive to the Dharma. Sorry, this is not a very good image, but that shows you the Buddha holding a lotus. A Chinese image of the Buddha holding a lotus. The blue lotuses, interestingly, are always shown just beginning to open, and you'll get the figure of Tara, green Tara, and she holds three of them. One as a bud, one as a half-open flower, and one as an almost-open flower. You can see them. I've seen the blue lotuses in the Cambridge Botanic Gardens. And it's worth going to find lotuses. There are some in Kew as well. They're like water lilies, but the difference between a lotus and a water lily is that a lotus, the flower comes right out of the water on a long stem and opens high up, while the water lily floats on the surface of the water. So, yeah, maybe that works for you, the lotus symbolism. A lot more one could say about it. Because as well as the unfolding, there's also the sense of purity. Mm-hmm. This beautiful, immaculate petals of the lotus, even if it's grown out of a very stinky, muddy ditch, or even a rubbish... apparently they even grow on rubbish heaps sometimes, lotuses. So you don't have... just because you're... your mind is a rubbish heap, it doesn't mean it can't produce lotus blossoms.
Phew.
So this is Tintin. So I was thinking, after the unfolding process, the symbol of unfolding, organic unfolding, we have the symbol of the path. So the path that takes you towards enlightenment. And one of the symbols for the process of spiritual development is the stupa. And this is from Tintin in Tibet. I've only put this one image in, but it's worth having a look at. He obviously did his research, Hergé, when he drew it. So they're very authentic Chortens. So you look at the stupa here, the Chorten, it's called in Tibet, and you have this very solid base, and then a rounded top, and then a number of rings, sometimes 13 rings. This has got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 rings. And then on the top there is a parasol or an inverted dish, and then a drop at the very top. But the older stupas, this is the one from Borobudur in Java. I wanted to show you this aerial shot because it shows how the stupa, with a complex stupa like this, also represents the path. Because what you do is, you first of all walk round it. I've done this, actually. And then you walk up to the first tier and you walk round that. And then you go into these sort of open-top tunnels. And you walk round that one. And then you go up to this one and you walk round this one. So you're walking in this big spiral. And as you do so, you're surrounded by these beautiful carved images of all sorts of Buddhist stories. And then you emerge on the very top and you get this fantastic view over all the paddy fields and the volcanoes on the horizon. And you're just surrounded by many, many stupas. And as you go, you keep seeing Buddha images. So it's a very complex symbol again, but it's trying to symbolise the path of spiritual progress.
Is that in India?
No, this is in Java.
Java.
In Java, yeah. And it's well worth visiting. It's one of the wonders of the world. I mean, it's a whole hill. Unfortunately, you can't see any people here, but if you could see a person, they'd be, there's stairs, they'd be very small like that.
How old is that?
That was built in the 700s, so it's pretty old. This is one of the very old stupas. This is Sanchi, and this was built around 200 BC originally, although it's, some of the more elaborate carvings are a bit later. And this shows you the primitive form of the stupa. The basic thing is a base, a hemispherical mound, a walled enclosure, which was originally a fire altar, and then a royal umbrella. There we go. So this shows, the basic form of the stupa. And this form of the stupa, I mean, the symbolism here, if you don't mind me being conceptual with it a little bit, we've got the earth and the water elements represented by the lower parts of it, which are receptive. And then we have the fire altar and the umbrellas, which are sort of active, and they're being brought together. It's as if all the elements in your life are somehow being united in the stupa. Mm. It's a very strong symbol, the stupa. It's massive, of course. It's an architectural thing. They're huge, although you can have small ones. We've got one or two here on the shrine or downstairs. And this is the one up in Milton Keynes. Quite similar in some ways to the one in Battersea Park. It's sort of Japanese style above eye level, but more Indian style below. It's a bit of a mixture. But you can see it's elaborated from that early form. You've still got the basic drum at the bottom and the dome, and then you've got a whole stack of umbrellas. And the fire altar has become this sort of roof at the top. There's a close-up of the central stupa at Borobudur in Java with one of the Buddhas. Each of these perforated stupas has got a Buddha half hidden inside it. Again, highly symbolic. And they are Buddhas with the teaching mudra, the Buddha Virochana, the central Buddha Virochana. This is a Vietnamese stupa, or pagoda we start to call them when they're like this. And here's something showing the symbolism of the stupa. There's a lot in this. First of all, we've got the element symbolism of the stupa, where you've got, in the symbolic form, the drum at the bottom becomes a red... actually, these colours are wrong, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Just realise. So normally, let's correct the colours. It's a yellow cube at the bottom, and then a blue sphere for water, and then normally a red cone. I'll have to get rid of this slide because it's got the wrong colours. A red cone for fire, and then a green dish shape for air, and then finally a flaming drop at the very top. And here you can see a range of the different stupas. I think it might be quite interesting to have a whole evening on the stupa to give you some more ideas about it. This is the Japanese shape, but the same thing, the yellow cube, the white sphere, the red cone, the dish, in this case black but usually green, and the blue jewel or drop on the top, representing not so much void but representing space or consciousness. So this is the way the stupa evolved. Now, there was another thing I was going to mention to do with the path, which I've skipped past because it was in the middle of the stupas. I've got my slides out of order, so I'm just going to go back to that. This one is fascinating, I think. You may have heard of the Zen ox herding pictures, and they show the spiritual path as a sequence of images, each of which shows a bull and a boy trying to catch the bull and tame it and ride it. And this is the Tibetan version, which is a little bit more complicated. It's amazing. It starts with the elephant and the monkey covered in mud. So the elephant represents resistance and slothfulness in meditation. The monkey represents distraction in meditation, an overactive mind. Initially, the distraction is leading the elephant. The elephant is the mind, actually. So the monkey is leading the elephant to the mind. And the me that's trying to meditate is this guy here. And he's trying to catch up with the elephant, but he just can't catch it. And he's got a hook in one hand, and he's got a lasso in the other hand. And then gradually as it goes along, for the fire represents his effort in meditation. And these things represent the senses. They represent sense distraction. So silk for touch, some fruits for taste, symbols with a C for sound. Smell is this conch shell full of perfume. And sight is this mirror here. So they are. It's a bit like a board game. You can make a board game out of it so that you can move stage by stage, and then you maybe go down the snake at some point and you'd be distracted by the different things. But you'll see, by the time he gets to here, there's a little bit of white. In other words, some of the mud has been washed off the elephant and the monkey. Here, he's actually managed to get the lasso on his tail, and the elephant is looking back. So your mind is actually starting to take some notice of what you're trying to do in your meditation. The monkey and the elephant are both looking back. Here he's actually caught it, properly caught it. Here he's now got in front of it and he's leading it. And then, you know, gradually the elephant, by this time it's very, very tame. By this time it's lost all its mud and it's lying down. And he's just sitting there very serenely. And then we get into the realms of fantasy and the transcendental as they start to walk up a rainbow into the sky. So this is the point of this is the point where you get to full samadhi. In other words, you get to full concentration and meditation. And this is wisdom as you zoom up the rainbows into the blue sky. And here he's holding the sword of wisdom as he rides on the back of the elephant.
Has the monkey disappeared about halfway?
The monkey disappears. Yes. So. After this point, there's no further distraction. So you're not distracted anymore at all. But there's still some mild sloth and torpor.
About on the bottom
line. Yeah. In fact, there's something else. If you look very carefully, a rabbit appears riding on the back of the elephant, which is subtle sloth and torpor. And that also, after a while, it's still here. But by this stage, that's disappeared as well.
What are those numbers in brackets?
Yeah, they're actually Western numbers, so I assume that somebody has actually put these numbers on, and so there's a key to explain what happens at each stage.
So is this a Western, was this made by a Western person?
No, it wasn't, no. No, it was made by a Tibetan, but a Westerner has added the numbers, I think. Or maybe a Tibetan who knew, but he was explaining it to Westerners, let's say. Okay, so that's the only one I've got of that, but I just wanted to show you an image of the path. a symbol of the path, if you like. We'll speed through these stupas again. Is this all right so far?
Yeah. The Milton Keynes stupa is not very attractive, is it?
I quite like it myself. Yeah. I don't know. What do you think? Have you been there?
Well, looking at that image there, that mix.
It's surrounded by cherry trees.
The Vietnamese one is lovely.
Yes, beautiful,
And the Borobudur one is lovely.
Yes.
But somehow you kind of combine the Indian and the...
Yeah. Yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah.
And it's a little bit...
So I just wanted to go on now to the symbol of the Vajra. And the Vajra, the thunderbolt, in other words... the thunderbolt is a sense of transformation and breaking through. And again, we may, if we're lucky, I'm hoping we'll have a whole evening on the Vajra, because everything in the Vajra has symbolic significance. There's one on the table over there, if you haven't had a close look at one. The usual standard Tibetan one, which has five prongs at each end, a sphere in the middle, and these animal heads coming out. And lotuses. Again, lotuses unfolding in two directions. But it's partly to do with the union of opposites, because one end represents the five poisons, the other end represents the five wisdoms. But they look the same. The one is transforming into the other. And it starts off, the Vajra, with it being held by a figure in this Greek-influenced art. It's actually called Vajrapani, which means the holder of the Vajra. But really, it's exactly modelled on Hercules. So Hercules is the first Vajrapani, the Greek hero Hercules. And then you'll find it in Japan here. It always has its own form in the different countries. So this is Vajrapani from Japan, wielding a long, single-pointed Vajra. And this one's from Nepal, at the big Svayabhanath stupa, if I pronounced that right.
What's the significance of the lightning bolt?
Well, its original significance is the power of breaking through obstacles.
Right.
It's the power of breaking through obstacles. The immense force. It was wielded by the god Indra in ancient Indian mythology, and then it became associated with the Buddha and became gradually spiritualized until in Tibetan Buddhism and Japanese Buddhism it has a very profound symbolic significance, not just as what breaks through, but also what represents transformation, as above, so below, the poisons transforming into the wisdoms. Okay, so here are the eight auspicious signs. So the Tibetans have, they're particularly popular in Tibet, and they are a collection of symbols. I could probably give a lecture on each of them, but I'll just tell you what they are. We've got our lotus that we've seen before. We've got our Dharma wheel, which we've seen before. We've got the royal parasol, which we saw on the top of the stupa, the symbol of royalty. Then we've also got the conch shell, which is the sound of the Dharma. We've got the endless knot, which is a symbol of interconnectedness, of everything connecting together. We've got the banner of victory, which is a symbol of a sort of an image of heroism. We've got the twin fish here. The twin fish represent apparently the freedom to swim in the ocean of samsara. The ocean is ordinary human life, and usually we are in danger of drowning in it. But the fish is completely free to swim. So the emblem of the fish is to remind you that it's possible to learn to swim in ordinary life and make it your home, to feel at home in it and not be drowned by it all. And then finally, this is the vase of the elixir of immortality, which is also used as for ordinations. You'll see these in Tibetan Buddhism and also in our own order, where water will be poured over somebody's head at the time of ordination. Another very interesting symbol.
Is that it looks like a Greek building in the background.
This is the shrine room in a British Tibetan Buddhist retreat centre.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. It's just got columns and stuff.
So it's a little bit influenced by the Greeks, maybe, but it's a modern building. And these are some little pendants or amulets that are associated with the eight auspicious signs. I like this one. This is a pavement artist's drawing of the fish leaping in the ocean, holding a jewel. And then I thought I'd mention that it's not just visual symbols. Dance is a symbol. This is Lama dances, Tibetan-style Lama dances, which all have their own significance. Something is conveyed to you by watching the dance. And then on to jewels. This is the same as on the Kesa, the three jewels. So the ideals of Buddhism are symbolized, as you probably know, by the three jewels. The Buddha jewel for the ideal of enlightenment that everybody has as a potential. The blue one as the Dharma jewel, the path to enlightenment, and the red one, red for passion, of the Sangha jewel, the jewel of friendship. I'm missing one or two slides. Some of these slides may come up at the end. I had another one of the three jewels. But here we've got jewels here. I mentioned this to somebody before we started, but apart from that person, anyone know what's going on here?
Is that Padmasambhava?
It's not Padmasambhava, no. I don't know whether it would be possible to guess. Maybe could anyone at least describe what is going on here?
Big fat guy.
Big fat guy.
There's something throwing up.
Something vomiting.
Something in his hand vomiting.
Yeah.
A rat or...
It's actually a mongoose.
A mongoose.
It's a mongoose vomiting treasure.
Wow. He's got an umbrella.
He's got an umbrella. Well, it's actually a banner of victory again. Right. It's a banner of victory. So this is Jambala. Jambala, who sometimes is regarded as an ordinary supernatural deity figure in Buddhism, and sometimes as a bodhisattva, associated with riches and exuberance and abundance. And so he has a mongoose, and he gently squeezes the mongoose. Each time he squeezes the mongoose, more jewels pour out of the mongoose's throat. So I thought I'd include this because some of the symbols in Buddhism can be quite bizarre. I've come across two explanations for this. One of them is the mongoose is known as the enemy of the snake. And it's said that the poison of the snake can be transformed into beauty, as it is in the peacock's tail. So it could be that that's why the... But the other thing, which is interesting, is that apparently in Central Asia, because of the size and shape of a mongoose, if you killed a mongoose and skinned it, it made an ideal purse.
Huh.
So when people wanted to pay for something, they would say, I'm going to go out and squeeze the mongoose. And then we come to a symbol, the great symbol of enlightenment and completion, which is the mandala. And we'll definitely be having, maybe, I think you might be giving a talk on the mandala.
I'm going to talk on the mandala.
Bailey is going to talk on the mandala, and Carmen Shee is going to talk on other aspects of the mandala. So I won't say much about it, but this is a sand mandala. This is a sand mandala. Again, full of emblems. Full of emblems. If you look around it, you'll see all these symbols that have been done in coloured sand. And here's a guy making a sand mandala. Very elaborate. Vajra. Jewels, the Dharma wheel, and the sword of wisdom, and the lotus in the middle. Some of these symbols come up again and again. To make a mandala is to take any prominent aspect of reality and surround it with beauty. So what Bodhilila would talk about is the mandala, where in the different segments you have a different Buddha, each of them with a different wisdom. And then around the edge of the mandala, we have three circles of protection. The circle of lotus petals for the process, the gradual process of unfoldment. The circle of vajras for determination and strength. And a circle of flames for the alchemical process of transmutation. And we can also use mandalas to look at Buddhist teachings. So the five spiritual faculties are arranged in a mandala, mindfulness at the center, wisdom and confidence balancing each other, meditation and enthusiasm balancing each other. And then, I don't know if this is a mandala exactly, but this is a nice woodcut, Western woodcut of the Enso, the Japanese symbol of completeness and emptiness, the hand-drawn circle, which you'll see in Japanese calligraphy very often. You know, a very deep symbol, so simple, but yet conveying so much. And then I thought, after all, symbolism can come through words as well, so maybe it's only fair to include a poem. So I thought I'd include, and the Buddha spoke, he would teach through symbols, he would teach through images, but he would also teach through words. Far-ranging is the mind, and it walks alone. It's not material, it sleeps in the cave of your heart. Keep it controlled, and you're free from the bonds of death.
The cave came up for me as a...
Yeah, that's interesting, yes.
I was thinking of the breathing.
Yeah.
That's partly because it felt a bit constricted.
Yeah. Yeah, the cave of your heart, the cave of the seclusion that can come through meditation. That's a strong symbol there, the cave of your heart. The bonds of death, of course, another far-ranging is the mind, and it walks alone. So the image of the pilgrim or the traveller is coming in there. Sleep. I'll just see if any of the images I missed are coming after this. No, they're not. No, that's another Buddha to end with. Okay, so that's a lot of stuff in there, isn't it? A lot to take in. And don't worry if you don't remember any of it at all, because we'll be revisiting these symbols. But I thought it might be quite nice to have a bit of an overview of the use of symbolism in Buddhism. And I hope you found that useful.